This is episode 63 of Attention Please with Arnab Ray on Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this on Sunday, the 24th of November, 2019, India time. But before we continue, let me tell you about another podcast that might interest you, Binge On. Every episode recommends stuff you can watch online based on a theme. So whether you're looking for a Tamil horror flick, new age Telugu movies, a Hindi web series, stand-up comedy, documentaries, or many more, there is an episode waiting just for you. So search for Binge On, B-I-N-G-E-O-N, on your podcast player or head over to anchor.fm/bingeon. And now let's welcome back our host who's back from what I think would have been a pilgrimage for him. Hey, Arnab.
Hello.
Are you still on your Kumar Sanu Nasha hangover?
Yes, it was an amazing concert. I didn't think that it would be this good. So I've been in this country since 99, and despite being such a huge Bollywood fan, I've always avoided going to Bollywood events. One of the reasons is, of course, for me, that this whole turn off and going to a grocery store and finding like these posters stuck there and it's usually Bollywood shows here are of like Salman Khan. This is one headliner and a number of you get Salman Khan and you get Sohail Khan, but you kind of know that Sohail Khan will be dancing and Salman Khan will possibly deign to appear on the stage. I'm not particularly interested in those kinds of shows. I'm interested in the sense that if it's playing anywhere near me and if it's accessible, I might go just to laugh at it. But it's not something which I feel any need to go to, because I'm not interested in watching Salman Khan dance or in watching Shah Rukh Khan dance. It's just not attractive enough. So I've kind of studiously avoided going to any of these shows. I used to stay in Long Island, which used to have a lot of these shows, usually sponsored by insurance agents, which was another reason perhaps that I kind of anyway. So when I heard that Kumar Sanu, Alka Yagnik and Udit Narayan were going to be on stage together, and they were doing a series of concert called 90s Throwback, I felt, no, but this one I really want to go to, because it has everything that, you know, it's this. First of all, it's not going to be headlined by any star. I don't want to go and see a star dancing. Okay, that's not something
you mean an actor.
An actor, like okay. Somebody coming out with essentially, you know, music playing in the background and dancing. I just don't understand the joy of that. I would rather watch a performance by a musical artist. So, you know, if it was Sonu Nigam, perhaps I would go. But this one was like, okay, this was like three people who I had basically grown up listening to, all my heartbreaks, all my disappointments, all my joys. I mean, these three basically provided the background music to my life. And it was a pilgrimage, because I wanted to just go and hear them sing. I wanted to see them together because of the effect they've had on my life. And I'm not exaggerating. That's true. And I also knew that, you know, I wouldn't possibly get an opportunity like this ever again to see all three of them together. I wish they had Abhijit also with them, so that would kind of have completed it, because I think he's also a part of that. I think he sounds some amazing. I mean, whatever you might think of Abhijit in his later persona, where I think he just became like a bitter troll, you have to accept that Abhijit has a brilliant voice.
He
still sounds good. I mean, he's of course a very, very good singer. You know, as a person, one of the things with any artist is that you have, at least I believe, you have to distinguish between the art and the artist. So I don't know how Kumar Sanu is as a human being. I mean, we definitely have come to know a lot more about Abhijit Banerjee as a human being than we would have liked to know. But that's why I don't want to know a lot about our stars. In this case, you know, these three people were coming, and I'd heard reviews that Kumar Sanu was here before, you know, about a month or so ago, playing some of the Durga Pujas, and somebody wrote that he was, you know, very off tune, and you know, I kind of figured that might be the case, because you know, none of these three are really in the prime of their singing career anymore, and I was kind of prepared for the disappointment that I'll go, they'll possibly sing off key, and you know, they're possibly not at their best, but I still thought, well, in any case, I'll go, because you know, when they hear, when I hear them singing, it'll possibly be the old songs which will play in my, you know, the songs as they used to be rather than what they're singing. And I thought it'd be good fun. And then I went there and I was like really pleasantly surprised, because I was most surprised by Kumar Sanu, because I thought he was brilliant. You know, he sung, you know, very, very well. And first of all, this was at the San Jose State University auditorium. And if you think it's a university auditorium, this is not Jadavpur University's Gandhi Bhavan by any chance, which was designed in such a brilliant way that the acoustics was that you couldn't hear anything in front of the stage. The sound basically was reflected to the street right outside. So you could hear it there, but you couldn't hear it inside. This was not anything like this. This was, you know, it looked like at least a Las Vegas hotel stage. And this is, seems like a very fun party school to be at if the stage is like that. And Kumar Sanu was enthusiastic. He was at the top of his game. He sung absolutely in tune. And he just had, you know, he just had a very good stage presence. I was really surprised. He was fun. He didn't talk too much, you know, because if you talk too much, you're not singing, right? So he didn't talk too much, but he didn't also just come out and just sing one after another. He didn't do that. So he engaged the audience to an extent. He sung, and it was a very, very heavy 3 hours. I mean, it was full of, there was not a lot of banter. The disappointment, of course, was Alka Yagnik. So Alka Yagnik, I felt, you know, several times she was off tune. You know, when the song started, sometimes what happened was, you know, it took her like 5 seconds or 10 seconds to kind of get in tune. But for the first five, ten seconds, it was pretty hard sitting through it. And I presume either it could be something of a voice, or it could be lack of practice, whatever it was. I also felt she looked the least, you know, practiced of all the three. And she also, I think, spent a little bit too much time talking. There was just too much of, you know, Saregama going on there for my liking. I wished she had sung a little bit more, but then, of course, perhaps not also. And Udit Narayan was kind of average. He was kind of dialing it in. He didn't go off tune, but he didn't really let loose also. Like Kumar Sanu let loose many times. I mean, he was like really stretching himself vocally. But Udit Narayan just stayed in this like comfort zone. Yeah. Safe zone. Perhaps this is the kind of singer he is, perhaps. But I also felt that perhaps not, because, you know, he's sung way better than that. I think he recognizes the limits of what he can do and what he can't. And he stayed safely within that. So it was a good, solid performance, but, you know, nothing spectacular in that respect. But Kumar Sanu was genuinely spectacular.
Let me ask you this. So when you go for a live show, do you expect the artist to, you know, give a spin to the old hits, or do you expect them to stay exactly true to what you've heard on the cassette?
No, I expect them to more or less stay true. I'm not paid money for them to reinterpret stuff. Okay. Especially when it's called a 90s throwback. Okay. If this is an artist who's currently, you know, in the market, like let's say an Arijit Singh, you know, I might expect him to sing a new song or something. But these guys, I don't want to hear any of their latest. Actually, Alka Yagnik sung one of her like recent songs, and that was the worst part of the concert, because I didn't even recognize what song is this. And why is it in a 90s throwback? If I can't recognize it, it obviously was not sung in the 90s. So I don't want, but you know, they can do a little bit, you know, they can go a little bit here and there, but I think it should not be more than 5%. I think 95%, right, especially in a nostalgia concert, they should sing exactly as they had sung. Now, what I would have liked a little bit perhaps more, and again, I understand that if you do that, you kind of take away from the 3 hours, is perhaps give a little bit of context to a song, you know, things which you don't know, kind of like a DVD extras thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, something about that song, some anecdote, you know, it would have just made it nice, but none of them went that way. I think Kumar Sanu once, I don't recall which song, but some song he said something about that song. But the others didn't at all. I mean, this guy, Udit Narayan, hardly talked. But overall, it was a very good experience. And if anybody who, you know, they're playing all over the US, I think they're playing all over the world. So, and if you're listening to this and you love the 90s, I mean, you would not be disappointed by it. I'm telling you, it was really good. And Kumar Sanu really surprised me. I mean, he sang this rendition of Dheere Dheere Se, which has, of course, been mauled recently by Honey Singh. And it was so beautiful, the version that he sang. It was the classic one. And but it sounded so different. You know, that's the whole thing about live singing. It's just a different kind of experience,
right?
Which cannot be matched by just listening to the song on a high end speakers.
It's and there's this entire thing about it being a shared experience, right, with thousands of other folks.
Yes, thousands of other folks. I you know, most of the people there were much older than I was, actually. And there were people who were younger. They were much younger who, of course, I didn't see too many people my age group. By the way, it's a very nice thing because I was standing there and people came up to me during the line and they kind of recognized me. I felt it. Of course, I'm not Kumar Sanu, but you know, I didn't tell them. You know, they said, oh, you're not. And so there were a lot of people there. Obviously, I knew that there would be a lot of people there who read my blog and stuff because you know, it's kind of a shared community, the 90s. But it was a very, very pleasant experience. I met a lot of people before that. I spent about a day or so in the San Jose area, and it was a great experience. Really, really enjoyed it. And again, I would recommend that, you know, if you can catch this show, you should, because I don't know how long these guys will. I mean, of course, they're none of them are old, but I mean, at this point of time, their voice is, you know, it's not going to get any better, really. So, you know, this is the best time to form the memories of the 90s. Okay.
Right.
So, moving on to the next topic. So, I was going to talk about the Maharashtra political thing, but...
Sultan of Bombay? The Sultan of Bombay?
Sultan of Bombay. And the problem with talking about this is, you know, this story changes as you talk. So I have no idea when you're listening to this, and I don't know. I'm pretty sure I don't even know what the latest that's going
on. It's like talking about a live cricket match, right?
No, with some live cricket matches, they're actually fixed beforehand. This one is actually not fixed. That there's no doubt about that. That this is changing all the time. And I think, you know, no matter how you look at it, I mean, ultimately, this is possibly politics at its cynical best. And, you know, one way of looking at it is this what our democracy has become? And on one hand of looking at it is, this is the sense of democracy. Because this basically simulates what the real world is. And that ultimately, you know, you have a party, Shiv Sena, which, you know, has a pre-electoral alliance, essentially, with the BJP. And when once they get elected, they want the chief ministership post and they don't get it. And at that point of time, the mandate of the electorate has already been violated. Because the mandate is not for NCP. And yet NCP comes in at that point of time. NCP comes in along with. So I think if BJP forms the government ultimately, I don't think it's a violation of the people's mandate in general. Now, as to the means that we're used to accomplish that, yes, of course, all of us know that it was not straightforward. It's never in Indian politics, it never has been an issue. You know, problem with issues it's always been who holds information about who and who has the biggest suitcase with notes. That's always been Indian politics. And I would say that's always been democracy. It's not just something which happens in India. It happens in every part, in any part of the world where there's a democratic system in place. And that's just one of the downsides of a democracy, that negotiations at the level of politics is never about issues, and it's never about ideology. It's all about pragmatism and, you know, power. Yes, indeed. I mean, how awesome is that the guy's last name is Power?
mean, you can't make up this shit.
Power versus power, and it's just like he's made for this. And for those of you who, I mean, Sharad Power is, you can write. I'm sure there will be great books written about him. He's really the Lannister of Indian politics. And this is not the first time he's done this. You know, as the song from DDLJ goes, "Dhanda hai ye uska purana."
I think in HHK, you mean?
Yes, HHK. Yes. So in 1978, he's been in and out of the Congress all his life. He's never really been a Congress guy. He's always been, you know, essentially a soldier of fortune. He's, you know, he's a political mercenary in the true sense of the term. So he, I think this was around 1977 or 1978, but he was ruling, you know, he was, and I'm not really up on Maharashtra politics, but he was initially, as far as I know, you know, a YB Chavan guy. I mean, he was his pupil and disciple. And then when the Congress party split, it was, you know, Indira Gandhi's Congress and Congress S. And I think they cobbled together a coalition. And in that coalition, of course, Sharad Pawar was kind of what Ajit Pawar is today, which is, you know, not on the front rank, the second rank. And so what he did was he basically broke that alliance by allying with the Janata Party. And Chandrasekhar at that point of time. And I think they took over. So this, you know, for those of you, again, is, you know, that happens to people when they see this, they say, oh my God, this is terrible. This has never happened before. Exactly something like this has happened before with Sharad Pawar as one of the main protagonists, except he was like, you know, almost more than 40 years younger at that point of time. But so this kind of breaking government and, you know, stabbing people in the back is something which comes very naturally to him. And this is what he's good at. I once compared, you know, Hillary Clinton to Sharad Pawar. And they're very similar to each other, I believe. They're very, very canny political. They're very, very canny in terms of politics. None of them are straight in any shape or form. And they're both, I think, pretty able administrators also. I think Sharad Pawar is a good administrator. And so is Hillary Clinton. And also, I feel it's very difficult to feel any kind of empathy or love for either of them, at least for me. They're not people who you feel, you know, I am a Sharad Pawar maniac. Like, for instance, the kind of devotion which Modi gets. I don't think Sharad Pawar ever gets that. Or the kind of, you know, thing that Bal Thackeray gets. He'll never get that. I think Sharad Pawar understands that. He doesn't want people's adulation. He basically wants your money. So I think he's a canny player, and I have always respected him. And it's fascinating to see him go up against Amit Shah. It's like Amit Shah versus Sharad Pawar. Possibly two very similar people, I would say, in many respects, in that sense that they both have immense political ambition, but they're not really the people who can stand and, you know, fill up an auditorium with their speech, you know. Unlike, say, a Modi, or unlike even, say, a Kejriwal. They're not people who people feel passionate for. But, you know, they are possibly two of the most powerful people in Indian politics today. And, you know, people are saying that, and by the way, when this is being recorded at this current point of time, you know, the BJP has formed the government, apparently. Though I don't see how they're going to be able to stand a show of strength in the House, given that many of the NCP legislators are claiming, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was true that they didn't know what they were signing. They thought they were signing for Shiv Sena, but then they found out that their signatures had been used for supporting BJP. And I'm not surprised by that. I really don't know if the Maharashtra government with the Fadnavis government will be able to stand up to a show of strength in the House. But I think that the reason why you want to form a government always, even before that, is because that gives you leverage. Once people know that you're in the government, that you've already had your toe in the door, then some of the independents, some of the more people who are sitting on the fence, then they start making a move. They'll wait for that. If you're not in the government, then there is another risk factor that is added to it. So I think this is the reason why Amit Shah, I mean, even if they cannot last beyond a few days, which might actually happen, I think that they get themselves into a better position by just, you know, just getting the ceremony in and just officially being in power. So there is a reason why this has come to pass. Now, a lot of speculation is going on that, you know, this is all a sham, a kind of Sultan of Delhi or race, for those of you so inclined, that ultimately Sharad Pawar is like Bipasa Basu. It was all his plan all along. And I wouldn't be surprised that this thing with Ajit Pawar is just shadow boxing. That the whole thing is that, you know, he met Narendra Modi a few days ago apparently to talk about farmer issues. Yeah, right. And that this is all part of a greater game in which this split is only in name, that Sharad Pawar knew that this was going to happen and that he's basically playing a role by being shocked. And, you know, the thing with Ajit Pawar is that it's not all been about, you know, chocolates and roses with Sharad Pawar. As many of you would know, there is a battle of succession between him and Sharad Pawar's daughter, Supriya Sule, I think. And so I don't think that Sharad Pawar was in the loop. I think that's a little bit too race in this case. I think he's genuinely been faced with the revolt. Now, it's very obvious, given the kind of ED cases that Ajit Pawar has on him, the kind of leverage that the BJP will have. So it makes sense why Ajit Pawar would swing and why Sharad Pawar might not. And I just don't see in this case what is the end game for Sharad Pawar if indeed this is all happening with his blessings. I don't know Maharashtra politics that well at all. If this was Bengal, perhaps I would have hazarded a guess. So I don't see, honestly, based on my limited understanding of Maharashtra politics, what Sharad Pawar would stand to gain by allying with the BJP while pretending to be not allied with the BJP. That part I don't get. I do get why Ajit Pawar would switch sides. It would be a combination of what the BJP has on him, and as well as a simmering resentment that he has that, you know, he's not ascending to the top spot because the boss's daughter is essentially ahead of him. So I get that. But of course, this was shocking, stunning. And I don't know if you saw, but, you know, Rajdeep Sardesai on India Today was a study. You know, his face, his jaw was literally dropping. As I had tweeted, it was like he's seen the end of Usual Suspects for the first time. When Kevin Spacey starts walking out, you know, he's seeing that thing. And he was really shocked. And that itself is worth the price of admission. And, This is beyond what you would normally see in Game of Thrones. It's almost impossible to think that, you know, you have a headlines in Hindu which says that Uddhav Thackeray is going to be the chief minister. And then when the thing comes out, somebody else is the chief minister. So, it's interesting and it's kind of sad in any ways because, you know, you don't want democracy to be like this because you ultimately have a case where a lot of people don't want to vote anymore. And the reason why they don't want to vote anymore is, does it really matter? Because ultimately it's going to be decided in the back rooms anyways. So that's what leaves me a little bit worried about these things, though there's a part of me, the Sultan of Delhi authored part of me, which actually loves this kind of political shenanigans, this kind of backbiting. This is what Big Boss is. I mean, not the scripted reality show with Salman Khan as the compare, but this is what really fun is. And I mean, I do enjoy this, but I also am aware of the detrimental effect this has in, you know, especially for young people, in terms of people who perhaps have some kind of idealism that I had in the 90s, which I, of course, no longer have, that they look at this and they feel, is this what democracy is? And, you know, I used to feel it at some point of time, too. I mean, when in 1989, when I was just barely a teen, at that point of time, I was really, really a pro, you know, very, very pro VP Singh person. This was the election which I followed most closely and with a lot of emotion when the Congress was defeated because the National Front one when BJP and CPM and
NTR led it
and Janata Dal, and VP Singh became the Prime Minister, and of course it was going to go south within months, but you know the kind of, you know, VP Singh for a generation was kind of what Arvind Kejriwal was when he came in. And while Kejriwal has, I believe, has been shown to be a gigantic fraud, I don't think VP Singh as a person was ever kind of, I mean, his his politics and his policies, of course. But it didn't take me a lot of time to realize that this was even worse than the government that they replaced, which was saying a lot. That at least with the previous government, there was like, now you had people like Devi Lal and people who were so shamelessly corrupt. So like before that, at least during Bofors and stuff, at least the Congress were ashamed. At least they were trying to say, no, we didn't do it. Then we come up, at least in my youth, I come up with politicians who say, you know what? So what I did it. At least Bansi Lal's chora didn't do it. My business is that he doesn't do it. Of course, my son Om Prakash Chautala will do it. So you know, we basically any kind of idealism that I had was gone after reading. And there was no social media in those days. There was no 24/7 news, and so it was only Newstrack, and it was DD, and it was the newspapers.
Oh, totally forgot about Newstrack. Thanks for reminding me about that.
you haven't heard of Newstrack?
No, that's what I totally forgot about Newstrack.
Yes. So
that was from India Today, wasn't it?
Yes, it was from India Today. And Newstrack was perhaps this was the only thing that we had which was very close to what you have with NDTV. But it was a video magazine. It came out on VHS. The only way we got to see it was because the Indian Institute of Management Calcutta Library subscribed to it. So we could bring the tapes and watch it at our house. Of course, we didn't have money to buy tapes in those days. Those tapes were freaking expensive. Oh, sorry. So those tapes were very expensive. So we obviously will not. We didn't have the money to buy them. So we used to rent them from the IMC campus, and it was a library. And it was very difficult to get it to because everybody would see it. Those who had a VCR, we had a VCP, which was a VCR light, and this was great. These were the things which had like live footage of the Babri Masjid demolition, which was totally blocked out.
Yes. That was probably the most distributed.
Yeah. So it had like Babri Masjid demolition. It had like real debates. It had real debates and good debates. It's not like, Arnab Goswami interviewing Altaf Hussain. Nothing like that. And I'm glad I got Altaf Hussain outright. I was going to say Altaf Raza. But that would have possibly made more sense. Have you seen that interview, by the way, Vikram?
I saw bits and I'm yet to see the complete one. Exactly. I saw him singing, for example.
So this was... The thing wasn't him singing, which was really funny. The thing was Arnab Goswami's serious face.
Exactly. I don't know how he maintained that.
How could a person hear this without laughing? Is something I had a Rajdeep Sardesai face while watching that. That how could this guy just sit through this in all seriousness with that stern expression on his face?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's some act, I would say. Anyway, so. Okay, all right. So now let's go on to the final story of today. So I wanted to talk about the JNU situation, which kind of has gone, it's kind of been displaced from the headlines by the sensational developments in Maharashtra. But there are a few things that I had to say on this. So that's why I felt, and again, the first thing that I wanted to say about it is that while most of you know what my opinion is, but I would still like to clarify that there are some things which I feel that need to be talked about. First of all, whether one of the things that has been consistently been brought up in many of the programs is that JNU, the fees are higher than other universities, other public universities in India already. And I think that's a valid point. I think that all public universities should have some kind of equitable fee structure. That if you are given the kind of federal structure that we have, I think there should be some kind of harmonization of fees. And the answer to it is not that fees all over will go down to the level that's the lowest, but will come down to somewhere close to the highest, which is what the market rate for that education is. And I don't think those are the market rates for the education even then. I think there's a substantial subsidy. And I think that there is a case that if somebody says, why should JNU students pay so much more than, you know, Aligarh Muslim University or some other place? I think that's a valid question to ask. And the solution to this is an equitable fee structure, which is not the lowest common multiple of all of them. It is actually somewhere close to, with some delta as to what a market rate would be. So again, this is again an example of in our narrative where a false logical connection is made, that why should we continue to subsidize JNU education at this rate when other people are subsidizing it even more? This is again using something which is wrong in one case to justify something which is wrong in another case. And this fallacy goes on, you know. In many cases, these same people call this whataboutery when the other side does it, but they're absolutely fine in doing this in this case. So then the second fallacy is, you know, you said, why are we building statues? Why are the MPs getting so much? Well, even if you think that government should not be making statues, even if the statues make their own money and it's essentially strategic investments, even if you feel that they're not strategic investments, if you feel that the government has no business making statues, I mean, my personal opinion is that the government can make statues only if it believes that the statues will recover their money and make a profit. The government is basically a large pool of money which we pool together so that the government invests it wisely. Okay, invests it wisely in two respects. Firstly, that they invest in places where private capital will not invest. So this is not a profit motive. This is a social motive. So the private capital will not invest in making, you know, in rural electrification, but because there just might not really be, given the amount of upfront investment you need to make in order to construct a power distribution system, there's no way that private capital is going to step in and do rural electrification. So rural electrification or transportation in remote areas, these are things that the government has to do. There's no profit motive in it. This is just equitable. This is just the way a country works. The second is that we expect the government to invest your money in strategic investments, whether it be in education, whether it be in funding research, whether it be in funding technologies like green technologies. You expect that, again, if the market for that does not exist or the market is considered too risky for the market, then the government steps in to invest in things which will have good social outcomes and will make some money or at least recover the money. This is what your idealized expectation for government should be. Now, of course, the world is not ideal. So, and for me, I'm pretty okay with MP salaries. I would actually prefer them to be a decent market rate. I mean, I hear, you know, his salary is 500 rupees a month. Okay. So obviously that guy is not surviving on 500 rupees a month, right? He's making money from somewhere else. I don't think that making MP salaries reasonable will reduce corruption. I don't believe that. But at least it's a starting point. I think if salaries are honorary, then you just provide one more justification for corruption. So I think that I like to think of MPs as, you know, any kind of administrative overhead that you have for administering any kind of fund, which, you know, if you invest in a mutual fund, there are people who are drawing salaries from it. So it's not that, you know, if you invest 100 rupees, that 100 rupees is going into the market. You know, 80 rupees is possibly going into the market and 20 rupees is paying for your overhead costs. So that to me is fundamentally not a wrong thing. And you can say that investing in students is also a part of that, what you just now pointed out, and I agree. So I'm not saying that the government should not subsidize education. I'm not saying that the government, I'm absolutely for, you know, government spending money on, for instance, primary education, full subsidy. And that's which brings me to the third point. And this is something which I pointed out in one of my tweets, is that Kanhaiya Kumar was on television saying that the government has, that the constitution assures right of education. So first of all, this is entirely, I hope he's not stupid enough to not understand what he's saying. I think he's doing it deliberately because most people will think so. But the right to education as codified in Article 21A of our Constitution is for children. It's not for adults. It's still 16 years old. So when you have something as a right to education, what it means is that the government is on the hook to provide you education. That is, if you cannot afford school, if you do not have access to school, it's your government's responsibility. And that's what the Constitution says. The Constitution in general lays out a superstructure for all the rights and responsibilities that that you have towards the government and the government has towards you. And the laws basically provide the specifics. So this is what Article 21A says. Now, I'm pretty sure that, you know, children, you know, that 16-year-olds, 6 to 16-year-olds are not studying in JNU. As I had said, people who are studying in JNU may have 6 to 16-year-old children themselves, but that does not mean that, you know, that the right to education carries over to their parents. Now, my response to that was bizarrely, what are you saying? That they don't, people above 16 don't have right to education? That they can't get educated? No, that's not what right to education means. Okay, so after 18, you have a right to get married. Okay, but the government is not on the hook to provide you a spouse. So you have a lot of rights to a lot of things. That is not what right to something means. So you have certain basic, so you definitely have a right to education after age 16, but that right is not a constitutionally assured right. It means that there's nothing in the laws which can prevent you from having an education. So that is that lesser, the lesser definition of right. But it doesn't mean that the government is on, it's the government's duty to provide you education after you're 16 years old. So this is a fundamental, I would presume deliberate in many cases, misinterpretation of what the notion of right is in terms of the Constitution and in terms of the contract between the private citizen and the government. So this is an important point that I wish to make. I mean, I did not pursue this further in the tweets because ultimately there's so much you can do there. But this is something which I want everybody to understand. So which brings me to the question as to, you know, why is JNU targeted? First of all, JNU occupies an inordinate amount of mind space. First of all, is because it's in Delhi. There are countless agitations going on with respect to fee hike. Any place where you have a fee hike, students protest. In Jadavpur University, where I used to study, they increased the library fee from like 2 paise per day. It was not even 2 paise. Perhaps it was a fraction of something paise per day. To something like 2 rupees per day, which was for libraries, okay, for library late fees. And there was a huge protest. And I remember some of the university professors gave their overdue books back to the library in protest. In friggin' protest. They had those books out for 15 years. 15 years they were overdue. And so this is bizarre. This is basically stealing from the university libraries. And there's not a lot of books to go around. There was no electronic books in those days. So, you know, you take it out, it's gone. Nobody has access to it. So these people who kind of fulminate about access and privilege took out access of the books to the people who needed it the most, the students, and kept it in their own private, you know, bookshelves. So, you know, the hypocrisy of this is staggering. Now, the question is, it's not true that the news doesn't cover it. For instance, Ravish Kumar has covered, you know, agitations of students everywhere. But in general, this does not come to the front pages. This does not come on the prime time slots. Whenever any other university does it, JNU has an inordinate amount of mind space, and it's because of the politics of JNU. And secondly, it's in Delhi. It's one of the premier institutes in Delhi where everybody states, and everything else is, to quote Rajdeep Sardesai, tyranny of distance. So of course they have everything gets amplified in and about JNU. So one of the things, and again, much of the JNU hate comes from the politics that's in JNU, which is, of course, ultra-left, anything which is about India or anything which is about Hinduism per se is kind of looked down upon. I mean, you basically deny the existence of the religion first. I mean, it's much has to do with about the scholarship that is engaged in JNU. And so, but does that justify, the JNU hate? And of course it doesn't. Because for me, I think it's important that at least in academic institutions, that there is a leeway given to, I would say, behavior and speech that normally would be looked down upon outside the walls of academia. I think that academia should be a safe space. And unfortunately, many of our woke liberati don't want that. They want all other forms of free speech to be stopped on campuses that does not, that triggers them. And this has been it's an issue. This is not just India. This is an issue which is very, very, you know, very
absolutely
top news, front page news. In and that's even Obama, you know, kind right. of called out this whole cancel culture.
But
I think it's very important that universities have to have a very, very high standard of what constitutes unacceptable speech. This is something which is, you know, kind of inherent in being part of the university. And when you join a university, that's been the case for hundreds of years. A university has been a marketplace of ideas. And these are ideas, some of which you will not agree with, some of which you will positively detest. But that does not mean that the idea that this market of ideas should be shut down or some shops should be gutted because they don't agree with your worldview. This is so. But unfortunately, you know, at least in this case, the students of JNU, they don't want, you know, the pervasive, the unions, which are of course left control, they don't want, you know, that kind of. So again, it's there's criticism of them too, but they have a point also that sure, you know, they have every right to have opinions that do not agree with the mainstream, and we have every right in the same way to call them out for it. But should the Indian taxpayer subsidize it? And I think my opinion is the content of the scholarship or the content of the opinion should not be a determinant of whether we subsidize it or not. That to me is very important. Do people stay on in JNU? I mean, are they inordinately old? Are they basically leeching off taxpayer money? Perhaps they are. But it's also true. There are two things. Firstly, I would like to point out two things. Firstly, it's not true. This is not a JNU problem. So I remember when I was doing my internship at Stanford, I was at that point of time obsessed with graduating early with my PhD. Okay. So by the way, I finished my PhD when I was, 28. Okay. I hadn't turned 28. I was going to turn 28. So I finished my PhD fairly early. And the reason why I did that was I wanted to choose a PhD advisor who did fast PhDs. Okay, so there's some people who just the professor was never satisfied with your thesis. So for me, it was very important that I graduate quickly because I wanted to get into the marketplace and make some money, like some serious money, which is not PhD stipend. So I was at Stanford and the professor I was working with asked me whether I wanted to join Stanford as his PhD student because, you know, you could transfer. And one of the things that I was worried about was how much that under that professor, people were taking like 6 years, 7 years to finish their PhD. Well, I wanted to finish it in 5. Absolutely. And so I asked some of his students, you know, why do you, I mean, these guys were like super smart. So it's not a question of them not being smart. And the answer that I got from most of them, many of them didn't answer it straightly, but one guy was like very direct about it. He said, look, man, he was a guy. He said, my wife works somewhere in the Bay Area, you know, so she makes the money. I get access to Stanford subsidized housing in Palo Alto, which is a very expensive city. And, you know, being part of Stanford, it gives me access to like programs, like everybody comes here to talk. We get great talks. We get, you know, great concerts. You know, we stay in one of the, you know, beautiful weather. Everything is accessible. I mean, why would I even graduate from this place? You know, but again, now you'd say, well, the Stanford is a private university. It's true, it's a private university, but it gets its grants from the government. The research grants that support the PhD students are coming from National Science Foundation and the US government. So in a way, they are government subsidized. Even my PhD was subsidized by the US federal government because, you know, for the 5 years that I was doing a PhD, I never paid a cent. All my money, it didn't come from the university either. It came from federal grants. I mean, okay, the first year it did come from the university because I was a teaching assistant, but I was providing a service. But after that, I was a research assistant all my life, and it came from DARPA projects and National Science Foundation projects. So now we'll come to the next question as to, you know, so what I'm trying to say is that staying on doing your PhD for the benefits that you get, and some people they just don't want to go out and make money, or they have some other reason why they want to stay, and it's not a question of just JNU. So that's one thing. And second is, in some cases with, and this is, and again, I'll be guilty of this myself, but just because somebody's taking a lot of years to do their PhD doesn't, it's not necessarily a reflection on their academic ability or their motivation. In some disciplines, it just does take a lot of time. In some disciplines, it's not just that it takes a lot of time, but these people, they have other responsibilities, especially people in JNU. They come, many of them come from very poor backgrounds. So they cannot provide, like I was privileged enough when I was in Stony Brook, I didn't have to worry about my parents. I didn't have to send any money back to India. I don't care. You know, I got my money. I spent it having, you know, Junior Whopper Burgers, you know, item number 3 in the Burger King menu. And I still remember the combo number 3. And so again, it was not good food, but I didn't have to worry about anything other than my own studies and my own petty desires. But I cannot say that everybody who does their PhD is so fortunate. That PhD, especially when you're like 28, 29, you have other responsibilities. And so those other responsibilities eat into the time that you can devote to your thesis. And unlike, and that's really why, one of the reasons why a PhD is not the same as doing a job, and that's why you get paid so much less, is that a PhD essentially works on, largely works on your schedule. While if you work outside in the real world, it doesn't work on your schedule. It works on somebody else's schedule. So that's one of the reasons why. So, you know, many people who make this criticism about JNU, they have never done a PhD, okay? And they don't even know what a PhD is. It's a very special thing. And the PhD, and a good PhD, gives a student the flexibility to do it in his time so that it kind of syncs with his life. I remember, and this will come back to my Stanford story, the reason why I wanted to do it fast was because I wanted to get a job and get married at that point of time. And I remember I talked to this professor who was offering me, and he said, when I told him that, he said, look, man, if your first priority is that how soon will I graduate with my PhD, essentially told me, don't even bother coming here. I'll give you an advice, get married, have kids. That's how I did my PhD. I first married, had kids, and then started doing my PhD so that I didn't have any of this going on. Because a PhD is not about how long am I in PhD. It's the journey itself. I mean, that was his philosophy. I don't think I agreed with it. That's why I didn't join him, even though, you know, of course, it was Stanford. But the point is that this is a significant philosophy when it comes to doing PhD, that it's the journey. And that PhD is something which happens along with your life. And if your life is complicated, if you don't have money, if you have other responsibilities, well, guess what? That time extends. So yes, there might be some people who are basically freeloading. And again, they're not in JNU, they're in Stanford also. Second is, they're not exactly freeloading. And thirdly is, you know, that is what you sign up for as a university when you're sponsoring PhD students. So I don't have much sympathy or much akinness to the politics of JNU, but I think that some of the things that they're being pilloried for are not really things that they should be, because that's really a part of, and if you scrutinize any university in which there's a PhD program, you'll find exactly this. This is not something which is typical to JNU. This is the same in US universities also. Which brings me to the last point, that some of the criticisms of JNU are basically criticisms on humanities. I saw this article where, have you seen the kind of research that, you know, that JNU students do? There was one of them, of course, was the one that would obviously get the most, you know,
attention. Yes, absolutely.
Samhita Ghabi and the Gujarati identity, something like that. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So again, this again is silly, because, you know, the people making this have no idea as to what research is.
And I didn't know Samhita Ghabi was Gujarati either.
Yeah, yeah, she was, of course, Gujarati, I think. Yeah, sure. Her husband is Ashok, remember? I think her last name is Patel, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, I didn't know that either. I didn't know her last name. Yeah, so Ashok's husband's name, of course, I don't know, but...
You're desperately trying to show that you haven't read Savita Bhabhi all
through. No, I know her husband keeps traveling, but I didn't know he had a last name.
Yes, I think it was Patel, if I'm not wrong. Okay. Because it's definitely... Because, again, I haven't read them in a while. Not that I've read them at all, but I think it is... I think there's something Gujarati about the thing. I guess so. Anyways, so but the thing is that there was some research article, and that's, I mean, that's true. This exact same criticism was used by some US politician, I can't remember who, about the kind of work that NSF and these places, that look at the kind of work that's coming out of it. So the problem with this is that this is the very nature of research. And again, this is the reason why people go and do PhD. This is why people who are doing PhD get paid less, because you get to do work on things that you're interested in, right? So if you're interested in, you know, these things, and by the way, and this is a very important thing, it's not that everybody who's doing work in STEM, in science, technology, that kind of research, are also doing research which can be monetized or which are of great significance to humanity. Okay, so much of academia, even in sciences, just navel gazing, nothing more than that. Is an incremental thing here, is an incremental thing there, and incremental to something which also doesn't matter much. So, I'm not in humanities, but I totally understand the angst of certain humanities students as to why do they get picked on. They get picked on because it's easy to understand that, okay, maybe this thesis topic isn't doing anything great to humankind. But if people could understand even science and computer science and all these theses, they will find that they're not much different. And that the purpose of a thesis, again, if you're doubting this, you're doubting the reason why you need a PhD. And that's a topic for another day, perhaps. But the purpose of a PhD thesis isn't to change humanity or isn't to pay back in terms of, as a strategic investment, the money that was spent on the person. That is really if that's your expectation, then guess what? You're going to be disappointed with pretty much 95% of all research. I think I'm exaggerating. It might even be 99.9% of all research in any discipline in any university. It's not that research grant given to Harvard or to MIT produces great things all the time. Okay, of course, better the university, they have a better chance of having greater, better outcome. But even then, it's any kind of research is always risky. And a lot of research really has, why? But the point of research, the real reason why that is significant, is because it's training that person. That person then, when he joins or when he or she joins academia, then that person has a training for doing research. It's not so much the topic. It's not so much the thesis. And so while I might say sound insane and, you don't know the context of that, it's ultimately the training that the person gets that helps. And I can say this having done my PhD myself. I mean, my PhD topic, my PhD thesis, again, to be honest, doesn't change anything. Okay, it doesn't create any new products. It doesn't advance, human knowledge in any shape or form beyond, a very minuscule little, a little blip on the surface. So, how can I criticize anybody else? And that's not just me. That's pretty much all the PhDs that I've seen. The significance of it was that I got trained. I got trained to do quite a few things which serve me in my life, which is this very podcast you're hearing. This, if you're hearing it for more than 60 episodes, I'm guessing you like it. It's taught me how to talk. It's taught me how to present an idea. It's taught me to look at both sides of anything, and it's taught me to anticipate counter arguments and counter them before the arguments are made. It's taught me to present complicated ideas in a simple fashion. This is what a PhD actually teaches you. It's not really the title of the thesis. So if you're going to use the title of thesis to criticize the education that I have got, well, then you don't really understand the education that I have got and why I did my PhD. And so the fact that many of the people are using this as a counter to JNU, again, there's a lot to criticize about JNU. I feel that education at the university level should be kind of somewhere where the market is. There can be some subsidies, but most subsidies of the government for education should go to primary education. I understand all of that, but I also understand the need for humanities. I also understand the need to have a PhD in humanities. I also understand that there will be people who will be doing their PhDs at different paces because of circumstances in their life. That does not mean that there will not be freeloaders and that there are people who abuse any system, but that doesn't mean that the system is fundamentally wrong. And ultimately, while there is a lot to be again, the reason why we hear so much of JNU is because the media chooses to focus their attention on JNU because of its location and because of its politics. Something like this is going on in every university at any point of time in the country. But nobody knows. Nobody cared about Jadavpur University's, you know, library fee hike, even in Calcutta at that point of time. And it basically shut Jadavpur down, university down for weeks. I'm pretty sure Diptokirti, who I think is the, and will vouch for that, because I think he was there too at that point of time. So he knows what a big deal it was. So the point is, these things happen. And while it's okay to criticize JNU and some things, it's okay to criticize Kanhaiya Kumar for his specious arguments. By the way, Kanhaiya Kumar was totally made by BJP and Times Now at that point of time. If people had not listened, just let him talk. There are people like Kanhaiya Kumar as in JNUSU for every year. And except that he's lucky in that his thing was picked up and then he became a celebrity and been living off that. So again, this thing has gone on for ages. It's just that JNU gets this amount of attention. But the point that I want to say is that, leaving aside the noise, there are other issues that you have to consider as to why people do a PhD, why people do a PhD in humanities, why people take so long a time to do their PhDs. And the point of this discussion was to lay out those things, because in all the kind of public debates that I hear on the news channels, nobody talks about these things. It's either you're an idiot or no, you're an idiot. You're a Modi stooge. No, you want to break up the country. That is not really what this is about. This is about something which is deeper, which is, what is education? What is a PhD? Should the government subsidize humanities PhDs? And my point is that there's no distinction. All PhDs research is essentially, so what? The point is, you know, the change that it brings in the life of students. And that is the point that I wish to make in this podcast. So thanks a lot for listening.
Okay. And that's our podcast for today. And since we were off last week, let me again remind you about Arnab's Patreon page. That's at patreon.com/greatbonk. Sorry about that. And if you're a subscriber, please do recommend the podcast to others who you think might enjoy it and help spread the word. So thanks for listening. And until next time, take care.